You're listening to Reality Sandwich Radio, where every Thursday at noon we serve up a palatable taste of the truth on topics of the mind, body, spirit, and our planet, community, and economy. To learn more about the Healthful Living model, go to healthfulliving.org. Reality Sandwich is hosted by Julie Matthews, Certified Nutrition Consultant, and Martin Matthews, Certified Medical Hypnotherapist. Past episodes of Reality Sandwich are available for free download at realitysandwichradio.com. Thanks for listening.
Rich relations.
You're listening to 89.5 KPOO San Francisco, and welcome to Reality Sandwich, where every Thursday at noon, we serve up a palatable taste of the truth on topics of the mind, the body, our community relations, economy, and all the areas of the Healthful Living model. And you can read more about that at healthfulliving.org. My name is Martin Matthews. I'm a certified medical hypnotherapist and Healthful Living advocate with Healthful Living. And you can hear this in all past shows of Reality Sandwich at realitysandwichradio.com. Now, today I'm really excited because we're going to be talking about politics, and we don't always get into politics on Reality Sandwich, but I just felt so compelled when I got an email a few weeks ago with the opportunity to invite local San Francisco candidate for supervisor in District 8, Alex Rosenthal, onto the show, because I just felt, you know, we've got to talk about what's going on in politics and this notion of understanding what's going on in our local community, where we live, what's happening directly around us, the issues and factors that impact our very well-being close to home. Global action begins right in your own home, knowing what's going on around your own environment. So to that end, I figured, you know what, let's bring Alex on. Let's talk about where she's coming from. She's a real person. She's here in the studio with me right now. Welcome, Alex Rosenthal.
Thanks, Martin. I'm really happy to be here.
Great. So I'm glad you're here as well. And, you know, let's just begin with, you know, a little bit of your background, because you're not a traditional, you know, lifelong politician kind of a person. I mean, you've been involved in the political arena. You've served the public for most of your life. You've been very interested in these, you know, in being involved.
This is my first race. Yes, it's terrifying, but really exciting and challenging. I'm president of the National Women's Political Caucus here in San Francisco, and I've been a lifelong civil rights and women's rights activist. I'm a deputy city attorney in the city of Oakland, which means that I write legislation for a living for the city council, and I also negotiate development deals on behalf of the people of Oakland. And I try to get the maximum community benefit out of developers in exchange for the right to develop in Oakland. And finally, I served as the president of the Elections Commission here in San Francisco during its second year. You may recall the ballot boxes floating in the bay a couple years back.
Yeah,
the commission was created in response to some serious problems at the Elections Department, and I'm really proud of the work that I did there on the Elections Commission, helping to turn the department around, and I had to make some really tough decisions. And it was that experience that taught me that San Francisco politics is a blood sport. It can get really ugly, but strangely, I loved it, and it was something that that really compelled me to run for office. It's something that taught me the lesson that the only way to live is to give back to your community, and that's really what I'm doing by running for office.
Mm-hmm. Well, good for you. So we can feel confident that our votes are going to be tallied properly in a few
weeks
here.
Yes, I think you can. The department is back on track. It's actually won some accolades in the last couple of years, and you know, every election has small problems, but this elections department seems to be back on track and much better than it was just 4 or 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Now, you are running in District 8, which is kind of Noe Valley type area and very, you know, pretty nice area of the city.
I can describe the boundaries for you. It's on the north side, it's up. The northern boundary is by Buena Vista Park, and it goes across over to parts of Twin Peaks. And on the then if you follow it around on the west side, it follows the ridge line along Diamond Heights and up along parts of Twin Peaks and then down to Diamond Heights. And then it goes all the way down to the Glen Park BART station. It includes the community of Glen Park. And then if you follow it up along the east side, it goes into the Intermission and includes it goes all the way up to Valencia and 17th Street. That is one of the corners. And so it follows Valencia and Guerrero all the way back up to Market and Octavia. It includes the Castro, Noe Valley, Glen Park, Diamond Heights, and parts of the Mission.
Okay. I've lived in San Francisco for 9 years now, and I'm really only beginning myself, since I've been paying more attention of late, to understand the role of the city supervisors and to really drill into my own mind my understanding that that's really my closest frontline representative in government.
Right.
In this case, my city government, where I am a citizen. I live here.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd like you to just share some of your thoughts about why people should be understanding and connected to who is their city supervisor. Who mm-hmm. is that person, and what role are they playing for them with regard to the fact that they are representing a certain number of citizens in a particular area?
So the Board of Supervisors, not everybody realizes this, the Board of Supervisors in San Francisco is the same as the city council anywhere else, because we're both a city and a county. Mostly counties have boards of supervisors and cities have city councils, but ours is one and the same. The Board of Supervisors writes legislation to solve your problems. It oversees the city's budget and in that process can help with management issues in the city departments. Why you should stay connected with your Board of Supervisors is because these are the elected officials who most directly affect your life, and because the services that the city provides, such as public transportation and the parks that you visit every week, and whether you need to get your dog licensed, things like that. These are things that really impact our lives, and mm-hmm. the decisions that the Board of Supervisors can make can directly impact your life in very real ways.
And that seems to be the closest connection, right? I mean, the most things that will affect us viscerally as living here in the city are things like, is something changing on my block with respect to parking legislation or the curbs, or suddenly I find out that I can't walk my dog in the park where I used to always. I mean, these are things that would affect me every single day,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
right? So when I'm, feeling angst towards, quote, the system, as I think sometimes people do, right? Oh, this should be changed. That's right. The first line of that is what's happening right in your own neighborhood.
That's right. And there are ways that the Board of Supervisors affect your life that you don't even realize. For example, housing in San Francisco has become extremely expensive, and it's becoming only more so. And what I would like to do with the Board of Supervisors is to be more proactive in protecting our affordable housing here in the city. This is something that the Board of Supervisors can do but hasn't done enough of. And I think most people don't realize that there are programs that the Board of Supervisors can promote to help first-time home buyers and also to protect renters better. And that's something that people, they don't necessarily realize that their local government has an impact on it, but it really, really does.
Well, let's back up a quick second and ask you about why are you running? What's compelled you to step out of your other work and say, I have got to run for city supervisor?
There's lots of reasons. I see the city changing in ways that I'm not happy with. And I was always raised with the ethic that if you see something that you don't like out there, you go out and change it yourself because nobody else is going to do it for you. And so my mother was the mayor of my hometown in Southern California as well, Claremont, California. And so I was raised with this kind of drive toward public service and this need to change the world around me if I see something wrong with it. And this drive to solve people's problems. The problems that I see happening that have really compelled me to run are some are basic city services and some are more kind of transcendental issues. Our public transportation system is in crisis. It's only gotten worse. There have been cuts to its budget in the last 6 years. And in fact, last year they cut their service hours by 7%. It has gotten to the point where the only people who are taking Muni are the people who absolutely have to, because they have no other way of getting around. And I think that that's a shame. And I think that that's something that city government absolutely has to fix. We've got to put the resources into Muni to get it back on track. And it's one of the reasons why I'm supporting the parking tax on the ballot this fall. There's a parking tax. It's Proposition E, which will it's a general revenue tax. It is not specifically dedicated towards Muni, but what I would like to see the revenues be dedicated towards is improving Muni and getting it back on track and removing the buses from traffic, et cetera, to make it faster and more reliable. The second issue, and the main reason why. Well, there are lots of reasons why we got to improve Muni, but one of the big reasons is that improving Muni will decrease unnecessary car trips around the city. Because if Muni is more reliable, people will start taking it. Mm-hmm. And decreasing our unnecessary car trips obviously reduces our carbon emissions and our dependence on foreign fuel. Saving the environment is not something that is just this ethereal idea out there. It is something that local government absolutely must start doing now. You know, the mayor has announced that we are, I think he said the greenest city or, you know, one of the greenest cities. And unfortunately, it's not true. You know, we're being outpaced by cities like Portland and Seattle and Chicago in environmental regulation. And I think it's a shame because San Francisco is San Francisco. You know, we're supposed to be at the cutting edge of this stuff. And we're just not. And I would like to see more time and energy dedicated at the Board of Supervisors towards saving the environment. And then finally, public safety and affordable housing are two things that I don't see the city government working hard enough on. I would like to see I'd like to protect the diverse mix of renters and homeowners in every neighborhood and make sure that we are protecting our affordable housing and that we're making it easier for folks to get into the home ownership market if that's what they want to do. And public safety, I'd like to see better community policing in our neighborhoods. I think that the police department, and specifically the POA, the Police Officers Association, has been really resistant to community policing, to getting out of their cars. You know, I was talking to a police officer just a couple days ago about the culture at the police department and how when they're at the academy, they are trained to respond to crime. They're not trained to prevent crime. They're not trained to walk around, get to know the neighbors, get to know the kids, figure out, you know, what the potential problems are before they occur. And I think that's a cultural shift that needs to happen at the police department.
Mm-hmm. Now, that's a hot subject that we can go off on, what's affecting, and just I'm thinking about it just now, so let's talk about that. The police, they used to say on the side of the cars, right, to protect and serve. Yet it seems and feels that that's really changed. And I don't know if it's simply because of the 9/11 thing or whatever, but it feels now like there's a sense of, you know, looking out for what people might be doing wrong. Yeah.
Right.
And that doesn't feel like safety. So, yeah, perhaps it's, you know, a cultural issue. I mean, I know the San Francisco Police Department has had its number of issues over the past number of years, and, you know, we don't have to get into all of that. But it's like, how do we create the kind of culture that the people of San Francisco truly themselves seem to desire and are. I mean, there's something very unique about this place. I mean, we know that about San Francisco and San Francisco culture, and we can call it, we can label it liberal, we can label it whatever. We can label it, as I would like to, innately human, as far as how we would desire to be able to get along and create and hire people in our local governments to represent us in ways that we can, you know, create the kind of city and direct those city funds the way that, you know, works for everyone. Yet, something as simple as the police department, how do we intervene there? How do we create a culture where it's, you know, their first and foremost understanding from where they're coming from is, you know, to protect and serve and, of course, you know, look out for the bad guys too.
Mm-hmm. The problem is the attitude at the police department, and don't get me wrong, it's not everybody at the police department. It is just some, and I think that it's a cultural shift that may already be starting but that I would like to enable is the attitude that the emphasis on punishment and prosecution, catching people after they've committed the crimes, as opposed to the kind of community service model, the public service model, which is getting to know the community. I mean, you know, we think of a Mayberry model where the, you know, the police and his deputy know everybody, they know all the neighbors, and mm-hmm. So fewer people commit the crimes because they know the cop is going to have to catch them and put them in jail. And maybe that's a little too idyllic. I actually think that that's not – obviously, you know, every cop can't know every single citizen. But I think that what we do need is a cultural shift in which the police officers view their role as being more of a public service role in preventing crime and because obviously whatever we're doing now isn't working. Our violent crime rates are up. They are reaching record levels our murder rate, I think, is the highest it's ever been. And so whatever we're doing now isn't working, which is why I'd like to move to a community policing model. Every other major city in America has looked at a community policing model, and most have implemented these things. But San Francisco has been particularly resistant to it, and I'm not sure why. And it's something that I would like to see the police department exploring. Ross Mercurimi, Supervisor Ross Mercurimi, wrote a piece of legislation that would have – it's a test of foot patrols that would bring – that would compel more police officers to get out of their cars and walk around on foot more often than they do in certain police stations around the city. And I supported that legislation. And I think it's really important to at least experiment with to see whether or not it's able to prevent crimes. And the Police Officers Association was resistant, and they said, "Oh, it's going to, you know, it's going to reduce our response times." But Mercurimi's response was, "You know, I'll sacrifice some response time if what we're going to do is prevent more crimes in the first place, because prevention is obviously much more important than catching someone after they've committed the crime."
Right, right. And working together with those authorities to create more of a community feeling of connectedness.
That's right.
So that we're all looking out for one another, both to protect and also to look out for people, you know, doing wrong.
That's right.
And to your earlier point that I completely agree with, it's like, how can things that we see that are not right, that we allow, we are being complicit in.
That's right.
Which, when we really stop and think about it, is not is likely not really true with, you know, what we really want to be doing. So we're creating internal dissonance and then disconnecting from our power of, you know, being able to truly affect what's happening in our world.
That's right.
And
if I can interject here, this
sure.
actually raises another idea out there that made me interested in running for this seat, which is, and this is a little strange for a politician to admit, but I am a Burning Man participant and enthusiast. Mm-hmm. I go to the Burning Man Arts Festival every year, and there's a lot of criticism of Burning Man. There's a lot of misconceptions about it. People call it, you know, the biggest drug party in the desert, and I think that's all hogwash. I think there are people who do drugs at Burning Man, but that's, for me, the emphasis is on the community, the intentional community of Burning Man.
Mm-hmm.
And the lesson of Burning Man for me is you get 40 and for those of your listeners who don't know what it is, it is essentially an intentional community of 40,000 people. At least this year it was 40,000 people who go to the desert in Nevada and create a city from scratch. We build it from scratch, and we tear it down within a couple weeks, and we leave no trace. And it is really an extraordinary model of what we human beings can do when we put our minds to it. We
Right.
create our own rules. It's a very live or let live kind of place, but we also have we have rules about, you know, how we treat each other, and they are the basic rules. But there's very little violence, very little crime out there, and in a city of 40,000 people, it's pretty extraordinary actually how well everybody gets along. And it is because it is this intentional community where it is so hard to get out there. You got to bring everything you need. You can't buy anything, so you got to bring all your water and your food and your camping gear and whatever else, your transportation, everything else that you need, you bring with you. And the lesson of that is, you know, we really can make our own rules up as we go, and we really can create a world in which we want to live. You know, a lot of us walk around in this world, in San Francisco or wherever else it is that we live, thinking, oh, that's just the way the world is, or,
right.
you know, the police are this way because that's the way it is, or our government is this way because that's the way it is. And the lesson of Burning Man to me is, actually, no, it is what we make it to be.
Right.
We can create the rules that we live by.
And those things that we say to ourselves, oh, it is the way that it is, only continue to be that way because we continue to reinforce it.
Exactly right.
And to become a part of it, even at our own dismay
right.
and our own internal angst.
That's right.
At Reality Sandwich Radio, listeners can go back to early September and hear an entire hour of Julie and I speaking about this year's Burning Man and our experience there, and you know, delving deeper into some of the points that you had touched there with respect to our ability to affect and co-create our environment. And there's so many similarities between what we can learn through that experiment, through that work, and directly applying it to life here in San Francisco. I mean, if we look at San Francisco, there's, what, less than 800,000 people here. We're a fairly small geographical area. It does take a lot to be here, and we are all here living here by choice. Yeah, various different neighborhoods that accommodate different types of people and different cultures and all these wonderful, beautiful, different, diverse things that we have going on in the city. And it's not always easy to be here, you know, and to stay here. Yeah, you know, there's people paying exorbitant sums of money to scrape together every month to stay in their one-bedroom, tiny little place, you know.
Right.
It's a lot of work, you know, to make it happen.
We could live in the suburbs and have three times as much real estate for the amount of rent that each of us pays or the amount of mortgage that each of us pays. But we choose to live here.
Right. And there's something else going on there with respect to the choice of us living closely together and pooling resources and all these types of things that we can make all kinds of parallels. But the point is, you know, you can't walk around disconnected and just angry about what it is that you're a part of. One of my greatest learnings from studying group dynamics and group psychology is understanding that just by simply being a part of something, you are contributing. Even if you think you're hanging out on the sidelines, I'm just watching here. You know, I'm just an observer. Well, yeah, nice to think that way, but you really are part of what's happening. And your non-participation is as impactful as your speaking up and saying what you want, regardless of whether you think saying what you want will get you what you want. But saying what you want at least starts something in motion that increases the likelihood of getting it.
That's right, which is why I'm going to encourage all of your listeners, if they are not registered to vote, to register before October 23rd. That is the easiest thing you can do to participate in your world. It really is, and it feels really good when you vote.
Yeah. What's the easiest way for people to do that right now? If they're listening and they're saying, oh, I wasn't going to, I don't have to, it's too difficult.
There's a couple places you can go to register to vote. My campaign office has voter registration forms. That's at 422 Haight Street at Webster, and we'll turn the forms in for you. You can also go to City Hall, go to the Department of Elections directly and fill out your form, and they'll enter your data right there, and they should be able to send you a receipt within the week. Hopefully, I think it's October 23rd is the deadline, so I can't remember how many days that is, but it's not too far away. But you do have until the 23rd to register to vote, and so even if you don't receive something in the mail saying you're registered, you will be able to vote. They'll give you a receipt,
okay,
that you can take in with you.
So there's all kinds of places I want to go here over the next while with you, but let me just ask you, what are some of the real hot button issues that are directly affecting District 8 that you get a sense really need to be addressed and mm-hmm. intervened with by a different representative from that area?
Well, there are lots of citywide issues that we talked about, whether affordable housing and public safety, improving Muni, and saving the environment. But specific to District 8, you know, there are lots of smaller things that need to change. But I'm, for example, in Noe Valley, there's a grocery store called Real Foods that closed down mm-hmm. about 3 years ago. And this may sound to some of your listeners like not a big deal, but to the people of Noe Valley, this is a very big deal. This store was shut down because the employees attempted to unionize, and the owners essentially shut it down so as to prevent their employees from unionizing. I think it was obviously a very drastic step, but they've also let the store stay fallow now for over 3 years, and it's blighted. It looks as though the roof is caving in. It's boarded. It's not boarded up, but it's papered up, and it looks like nothing is happening there. I've been very disappointed in city's leadership and not doing anything about it. I don't know why they haven't threatened these folks with eminent domain proceedings. I don't know why they haven't fined them for having a blighted property or brought them to the table. And the current supervisor says that he's been working with the owner and he's been communicating with the owner, but it's been 3.5 years or more, and I think that time is up. I'm a real estate attorney. What I do for a living is negotiate deals with property owners, and I'm pretty confident I can bring these folks to the table.
Mm-hmm.
By hook or by crook, we got to get these people to the table.
Right.
You know, there's issues in Glen Park with parking and congestion. There are some very dangerous intersections in Glen Park that I would like to see remediated. And there's a Glen Park community plan that the community put together with the help of city planners, and they did a really great job, and they got a lot of community input, and there's all kinds of great things in there to improve the community parking and congestion issues. And they really haven't been implemented, and I'm really disappointed that the current supervisor hasn't really used his leadership abilities to get the thing implemented. And it seems to me as though he's kind of neglected Glen Park. you know, there are all kinds of individual muni lines that I think need to be improved, but I won't list them off here because there are so many of them. The 24 in particular, I'll mention, is pretty bad. My bus line, the 37, is really bad in terms of reliability and speed. There's all kinds of problems with Muni that are going to be fixed in the coming year and that I really want to take a leadership role in. The controller's office is conducting a transit efficiency study that I really look forward to supporting. You know, we haven't analyzed our public transportation systems in more than 20, at least on a comprehensive basis, in more than 25 years. And it's about time that we figured out where our bus lines are going and whether or not they're properly serving our communities, given the demographic changes that have happened and the population shifts in the last 25 years. And so the results of that are coming out really soon, and I'm really looking forward to implementing that report and changing around these bus lines if that's what we have to do to make it more efficient.
How is San Francisco doing versus some other notable cities? We touched on this very briefly earlier. Portland comes to mind, of course, for me with respect to public transportation. And how are we doing?
We have the second slowest bus system in the country. The first slowest is New York City.
Hmm.
And the main reason is because the buses are stuck in traffic with all the taxis and cars. And there are so many more things that we can be doing to improve Muni that we're just not doing because we're blaming it on budget cuts. And frankly, that's because I think the city doesn't have the political will to just dedicate the funds necessary. And unfortunately, what that means is we're going to have to pay more in taxes. And that's why I'm supporting the parking tax. You know, it is not a politically popular thing to do for a politician to say I'm supporting a tax. But the money's got to come from somewhere. And I would rather it come from a new parking tax than from, you know, an AIDS clinic service, for example, or a hospital. And so the things that we can do to start improving Muni include lowering the bus floors so it's easier for folks to get off and on the bus. Transit-only lanes that get the buses out of traffic, but then you got to enforce the transit-only lanes, you know, to actually keep other cars out of those lanes. There are proof of payment services like smart cards that you can just swipe and just get right onto the bus and not have
Why
to put
your coins
in. Why
don't we have that?
Doesn't it seem like every other city in America
Why
has this?
Why don't we have a Metro card?
I know.
Like, you know, most other places have that you can buy and store and refill. And why are we constantly still futzing with quarters and exact change and all this inhibition to utilizing the system? And what did they do? I don't know if you have the answer to this, but it's on my mind. What did they do with the extra 50 cents they got over the past couple of years, right? So they increased their fares and get budgets getting decreased and services going
down.
Right.
I don't know why. To answer your first question, I have no idea why we're still on a cash-based system. And we must be the last major city in America that still uses cash on its buses. Second question is, the reason why they increased their rates is because their ridership is down. The ridership is down because they decrease their service hours. So the buses are less reliable and they come less often. And so it's no wonder that ridership is down.
Yeah.
And so they increase their fares to make up their revenues because ridership is down. And then ridership goes down even further. And it's this horrible downward spiral. Ridership is going to continue to go down the less reliable the buses are. And so, you know, Spur is an urban research organization in the city, and its transportation policy papers are actually really quite good, and they wrote a piece called Muni's $1 billion Problem. And essentially what they said is, oh, and by the way, Spur is not a particularly progressive organization. You know, they're nonpartisan, and the one – this paper argued in favor of either new taxes or some new revenue source. We need to just start putting money into Muni, period. We need it to be more heavily subsidized. The management attitude has been that the fares need to pay for the service, and clearly that's not working.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever we're doing now isn't working.
Right. So who will the new tax affect, the parking tax? Is that going to be on?
It's going to be on commercial lots and garages.
Mm-hmm.
Everywhere in the city, that's my understanding, is that every space will, or I think it's, you know, every space will have a certain surcharge on the parking, on the users. So it'll be passed on to the folks who are driving and parking in these lots.
Right. Boy, well, you know, the transportation issue is just, for a small city like this, you know, if it worked, fluidly, I think people would just use it so much more often. I mean, I know I will, you know, own up to having made my own vehicular journey downtown for a quick something or other when, you know, just the frustration of not being able to just jump on a 7 and go, like I could do even a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. They were more frequent. It was fast. It was there. Now it's like, you know, chug-a-lug just trying to get on a bus.
Yeah.
Let's switch to housing for a bit. I mean, we're in a city here where, what is it, 60, 70% of?
I think it's 70% citywide. It's 66% in District 8.
The people
are renters.
Are renters.
Yeah.
Right. So it's, you know, that's quite a lot of people that are paying a monthly, you know, rent out the window and are under some provision, right? Some sort of rent protection type things. But what are the big issues that we're that you see with respect to, you know, protecting renters?
I have been really dismayed to learn about the high number of Ellis Act evictions in District 8. The Ellis Act enables a property owner to clear a building of tenants in order to quote get out of the rental business. And usually what it's used for is a property owner who wants to clear the building of tenants so they can sell the building as a tenancy in common to prepare it for condo conversion. And so the Ellis Act has one purpose as far as I'm concerned, and that is so that the property owner can make more money off of the displacement of tenants. It is totally abhorrent, and it should be overturned. Unfortunately, the only way to do that is at the state level. And our assemblyman, Mark Leno, says that he doesn't think there's the political will to do that statewide. You know, obviously there's the will in San Francisco. I think most folks in San Francisco, most politicians in San Francisco are against the use of the Ellis Act. And I think that there's more that the city can do to protect renters from the use of the Ellis Act in making it less profitable for real estate speculators to use it. I would like to make it a little bit harder for folks to clear buildings of tenants, maybe a lot harder for folks to clear buildings of tenants, particularly when the only reason to do so is the profit motive. Obviously, if somebody – an owner move-in eviction is not a problem if somebody is genuinely moving into a building. They've got to be able to displace the tenant who's there. But there are a lot of fraudulent owner move-in evictions. There are a lot of fraudulent Ellis Act evictions. And I think the problem is real estate speculation, and it makes me sad because I can't tell you how many friends I've had who've been kicked out of their buildings under questionable causes, questionable Ellis Act, use of the Ellis Act and owner move-in evictions. I've recently discovered that the AIDS Housing Alliance San Francisco has said that there have been 1,000 people Ellis Act evicted out of District 8 in the last 5 years who are either disabled or elderly. And that is totally shameful. It is totally shameful, particularly since we know that in District 8 contains the Castro, mm-hmm. you know, which is a predominantly gay neighborhood. And we know that a lot of the folks who are disabled who are getting evicted out of the Castro have HIV and AIDS.
Mm-hmm.
And what AIDS Housing Alliance SF says is that when you get evicted from your place and you have HIV and AIDS, it can accelerate your death by as much as 5 times the natural rate. And that is something that city government cannot stand idly by while that's happening. We've got to protect our disabled and elderly tenants.
Right, right. Boy, 1,000 people knocked out of their homes for, well, I'm going to say profit motive, but, you know, let's shift for a bit to the environment. You and I were talking a little bit before about, environmental impact. Number one is an offshoot of, you know, the transportation issues and all these buses running around and things like that. But also the city's stance on being a green city, right, as compared to other cities. I mean, here we are. We're San Francisco, for goodness sake. We should be able to collectively take a stance to get ourselves as green as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Are we doing it? What can we do? And what kind of stance can we bring as far as a shift to the Board of Supervisors who represent us all?
Have you seen the Al Gore movie, An Inconvenient Truth?
I have.
It is an amazing movie, and it is one of the things that really motivated me to run for office.
Mm-hmm.
For those of your listeners who haven't heard about the movie, although most of them probably have heard about the movie, it is a really eye-opening experience. Al Gore goes through his slideshow talking about the effects of global warming and how it has affected our world in real terms. You know, what global warming is, why it's happening, how it is a human caused phenomenon, and how it's affecting our daily lives. And most of us who live in San Francisco realize that this is the warmest summer on record. I mean, it was remarkable how warm it really was, and it's only going to get warmer. Mm-hmm. You know, I have some friends who joke that, you know, global warming isn't so bad for San Francisco because it takes our average temperature from 60 to 70.
Right, right.
But for the rest of the world, it is actually a really major problem. It is having global climate changes, impacts on our global climate that can be catastrophic. And we're not just talking about the water level rising just a foot in the next decade. We're talking about catastrophic environmental disasters like Katrina every single year. Mm-hmm. I mean, the lower half of Manhattan could easily be flooded with another hurricane, things like that. And so this is not a theory. This is not something out there that we need to just kind of sort of start thinking about renewable energy sources. We need to start taking bold steps now in the direction of saving the environment. I'd like to see all new construction to be LEED certified starting next year. LEED certification is it's an environmental certification process whereby whoever is building the building, if they use a certain level of renewable energy sources or recycled materials, or they recycle the materials that they demolished, et cetera, there's a whole list of criteria that you can use to get LEED certified. Right now, we don't have any criteria like that on new construction, and I'd like to impose it. You know, it's time. Some of the LEED certification levels do not require that much capital cost. In fact, they can save money in lots of cases because you can get some buildings off the grid and stop paying PG&E for your power. You can actually use renewable energy sources, which can be a lot less expensive.
Right.
We can also go towards green roofs which are not necessarily rooftop gardens, but can be just, you know, layers of grass and wildflowers that can really help the environment. I've been teased for this idea because a lot of people say, oh, you know, we're not all going to have rooftop gardens. They're very expensive. How can we possibly all do this? How can we all convert our roofs to beautiful lawns? And that's not the point. Really, there are other major cities that are using green roofs and are experimenting with it, including Chicago and New York City and Portland.
Mm-hmm.
And also I'd like to help homeowners convert their buildings to solar power. There are federal and state dollars that are available to help private homeowners and private building owners to convert their buildings to solar power. And I don't think that the city has properly leveraged that money. And I'd also like to provide a local subsidy. It can be expensive to convert your building. You know, my home has been estimated to cost, it'll probably cost me about $40,000 to do it, or maybe slightly less. And that's a lot of money for me.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot of money for anybody who only owns their home and doesn't own any other real estate. But there are things that the city can be doing to help convert folks over to solar. So we can start reducing our dependence on foreign fuel, start reducing our carbon emissions. And, you know, these are just a couple of ideas of things that we can be doing to start saving the environment. And start not just patting people on the back for complying and for recycling and for doing these things, but actually starting to require them, because unfortunately, I think that's what it's going to take.
Well, yeah. And, you know, when you were talking about the, I forget the term, for the construction?
LEED certification.
LEED certification, right? Sounds to me like saying, look, there are methods that we know that, as far as new construction processes, that are, you know, less negatively impactful on the environment and use certain types of materials and all these kind of things that we've, you know, been tremendous strides with respect to construction capability over the last number of years. And still, I know that very often when companies, whatever, take over a piece of land, there's always sort of an agreement that as part of building something, you have to also greenify, so to speak, you know, certain areas, right? So we're in cahoots with that. That's a really great idea.
Mm-hmm.
So why not just make it a default standard?
Yep.
That we should be, that if you want to build something here, you've got to be doing it as best as possible. So that at least we're discontinuing the current way, which we know is excessive and wasteful, albeit maybe, you know, cheaper and more profitable.
Mm-hmm.
But how are we going to somehow, as a city, get together and set some standards that will only be affected, you know, down the line and in the future? But if we keep vacillating, I mean, this is what happens. This is my greatest frustration with, you know, with governments, right, is that there's more effort put on, you know, vacillating and debate and talking about it, not really being sure and never really wanting to make a significant determination because we might be wrong, and then we'll just talk about it forever, ever, and ever. And never really, you know, make a huge decision. Not unlike single individuals often mm-hmm. do, right? Mm-hmm. I'll just avoid making a decision on something and just deal with it later.
Yep.
You know, but the world is changing so much now that there's things that we just can't continue to back burner.
The world demands bold leadership on these issues. It absolutely does. Waffling time is over. We need bold leadership to lead us into a sustainable future. It is no joke that San Francisco could very well be the next Katrina or Manhattan or Seattle or whatever city it is that is on the coast is, or, you know, boy, Al Gore really should start paying me because I'm talking about this movie everywhere I go. You know, it was such an eye opener about all the various natural disasters that could really start happening very, very soon if we don't start taking bold action. And it really takes leadership. It is strong leadership that we need right now.
Well, let's just continue right on that subject since we are on Reality Sandwich. What are some things that you see going on here in San Francisco right now that the average listener may not be tuned into that they should be so they themselves can perhaps wake up a bit to their own bold action of, number one, getting out and voting.
Right.
And truly being somewhat connected with who they're voting for and having some why behind it. You know what? I like this person for this reason because I want to, you know, whatever it is. What do we need to know about that we're not getting tuned into?
Oh, there's so much. I don't even know where to begin. For example, you know, one of the reasons why I'm running is because I feel like the culture of San Francisco is changing that in a direction that no longer supports the arts, that no longer supports street fairs. And this is just a tiny little example, but something that I've seen in the last couple of years is the concerns of individual neighbors who live near where a certain street fair or party, an annual party, is being held, has complained about these things and has been enabled to either shut down a party or a street fair or to threaten its existence. For example, Halloween in the Castro is an annual celebration that has grown over the years. And in the last couple of years, there have been a couple incidents of violence and property damage, and it has definitely become problematic. The neighbors have been complaining. My opponent, the incumbent, has announced that he is ready to cancel Halloween in the Castro. Mm. At least 100,000 people come to this thing every year. And admittedly, you know, there is some property damage and some violence, but the problem is not the party. The problem is in the city's failure to properly manage the party. And besides, what's it going to take to cancel Halloween in the Castro? Does it take, you know, 500 police officers on horseback in riot gear? Mm. People are going to show up anyway, whether or not we decide that we're, quote, canceling it. This is something that is not just about Halloween in the Castro. It's not just about the party getting out of control. This is a cultural shift. Reggae in the Park was closed down last year. They canceled it for similar concerns. The North Beach Jazz Fest was almost shut down because of concerns about where the alcohol was being sold and whether or not, you know, there could be children there or you know, they were going to have beer gardens, but then they weren't sure where they were going to be, and the neighbors threatened to shut it down because of these concerns. And the Howard Street Fair was almost shut down because they tripled their police fees and they weren't going to be able to afford to continue to hold the event. And I think that, you know, these are things that if the folks who go to these events, if they stand up and start talking about it and resisting and saying, hey, I like Halloween in the Castro, or at least I want the city to better manage it so that I can like it and so that I can have a good time. I like Reggae in the Park. I like North Beach Jazz Fest. And the problem is the people who scream the loudest are the ones who get the most attention. And it is the neighbors around these street fairs who are screaming the loudest at this moment. And the folks who attend these parties and the folks who have a good time at the city's cultural events aren't speaking up. And I would really like to see that happen. You know, this year's Halloween, and your listeners should know that this year's Halloween party is going to be very different than it has been in the past. Supervisor Dufty, the incumbent, has announced that they are reducing the number of entertainment stages down from 3 to 1. They are shutting down the party at 10:30, and they are they're turning on elevator music at that time, and they are bringing in the street cleaning water trucks at 11 o'clock so as to clear the streets of all the revelers. I've attended these community meetings to talk about it, and what Supervisor Dufty and the police have announced is that they want to make this year's Halloween an unpleasant experience.
Mm.
And that is what is so terrible and is really very sad because the goal is to shut it down in subsequent years, is to make it such an unpleasant experience this year that fewer people come next year. And like I said, you know, I'm not for property damage and violence. That stuff has to stop. But the answer is properly managing the event. It is not shutting it down completely. I want to live in a San Francisco that celebrates our arts and our nightlife and our culture. I moved to San Francisco for the reasons you mentioned, because I like an urban atmosphere. I like having really great restaurants and good theater and good culture and good street fairs. And Halloween, it's not going to stop at Halloween. If we're successful in stopping Halloween, what's next? Are they going to take out the North Beach Street Fair, the North Beach Jazz Fest completely? Are they going to stop Burning Man's decompression because of neighborhood concerns? And so this is where the fight is this year. And, you know, I would love to see people write letters to the editor. I'd love to see people come out and vote their, and speak their minds about it, because this is something that's changing, and it's changing right under our noses.
And is that a citywide change? I mean, are you feeling that the city itself collectively is taking on this bent towards, I don't know what it is. I have this sense that, you know, monetary issues are, you know, really at play with respect to choices being made that affect the city and neighborhoods and development. And, you know, it's about revenue.
A lot of it's about revenue. A lot of it's about real estate interests. You know, I'm a homeowner, and I live at the top of the hill above where the Halloween and the Castro Street Fair happens. And there's all kinds of stuff that happens in my neighborhood. I'm probably a half a mile away, maybe a little bit less, and I'm way at the top of the hill. I'm always amazed that people are willing to walk that far to park their cars for Halloween, but they do. And it's one night out of the year, and I pick up the cups that are sitting in the middle of my sidewalk, you know, the day after Halloween, and it's not a big deal. But a lot of folks, you know, the older we get, and, you know, maybe they've been to the Halloween celebration long enough to know what a miserable experience it is and how many crowds there are and how many outsiders there are. It can be a really unpleasant experience. But the people who live there are the ones with the most vested interest in shutting down the party. And I wish that people would remember what it was like when they first moved to San Francisco, and with all of the parties and street fairs and nightlife, and how fun it was for them when they first moved here. I wish that folks would keep an open mind about these things and remember that the answer is not closing down the party. It is thinking creatively about the answer. And I think that it's not so much an economic answer at City Hall. I think that it is a lack of creativity. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, when I heard that the answer to the party becoming a problem in Halloween was shutting it down, I thought, oh my God, you know, this is the problem with City Hall, is that it's all or nothing. It's black or white, when really there's all kinds of shades of gray in the middle.
Right. And, those decisions are so easy when your default is to avoid the hard work.
Right.
And the creativity.
Right. That's right.
You know, how do we make this happen, as opposed to, oh, let's just end it.
Right.
There's too much, in my opinion, here's where I get to go off my own tangent here in the last 5 minutes of the show. Just too much short-sighted thinking. We've got a challenge. Something's difficult. Oh, let's just end it. And I can deviate into all kinds of diatribes, but just the other day, you know, whether it's marriage or a job or a disagreement with something, it's like when it gets tough, what do? Quit. Leave. Get out. End it. And it's the natural thing to do to terminate the pain, right? There's pain in the Castro with respect to this party happening, and it's affecting certain things. So quickest answer, oh, end it, knock it out, stop it, rather than doing the hard work, which really isn't that hard, but it takes creativity, like you say, to say, okay, well, how can we make this work? What do we have to do? Avoid that part. Let's go back to just ending it. And, you know, the real solutions to anything in the world come through sitting down and being creative and first putting a stick in the ground saying, this thing, whatever it is important enough to us. It's part of who we are. Let's figure out how to make it work, whether it's figuring out how to get Muni to really work and serve all of our needs. You know, it does take hard work to stop, assess the system. Are these lines that we're running that we used to run for 25 years still working, like you were saying? You know, what's the real hard work? So, you know, I think that's my piece to put out there to listeners, to voters. Number one, you have to be registered. You have to vote. You have to participate in your system, number one. Second, to whatever extent you can have some affinity for who is representing you, because you are hiring these people. If you live here, you vote, you're hiring politicians. Politicians are not just people that come along and, you know, looking after their own interest and, you know, want to do whatever it is you don't like about them. They're who you hire represent you.
Yep, that's right.
And to represent your interests on a larger scale, in this case, this city. So know who they are, understand who they are, see how they resonate with you personally as far as how you feel that they're going to be speaking on your behalf. And then make your choice about who you want to be doing that job, because that's the deal.
I encourage your listeners to, every politician nowadays has a website. Mm-hmm. Before you vote, go to their website, Google their name, and go to their website, see how they're representing themselves, and see who is supporting them, see who's endorsing them.
Mm-hmm.
That is probably the most important thing that a voter can do, is don't just read what they want to do, see who agrees with them. And, you know, if you're a renter and you see that a landlord's association is supporting a candidate, you can think that maybe, you know, maybe they don't have your best interest in mind as a renter. You know, same thing with, you know, whatever it is your interest is, you can see who is supporting the candidates. And I strongly recommend that you go to their websites and check that out.
Alex, thanks for coming in today.
Thank you.
This has been great. I've enjoyed the conversation, and I implore people to go to your website and check you out and see what they can learn about both candidates in District 8, if that's where they live and that's where they're going to vote. And if you're not in District 8, just listen to the show again and have it stir your own thoughts about your involvement in your community, in local politics, really just, you know, who you are and the role that you're playing in the world. And you know, why it is you live in San Francisco. What do you want to be a part of, and what's your involvement? And I believe you'll find that the more that you even just give thought to those things, the more that you'll feel connected. And the more that you feel connected, the more that you can feel comfortable and in some regard at peace, and hopefully a choice about, you know, what it is that you're creating in your world. So those are a few of my thoughts. You've been listening to Reality Sandwich. We are on every Thursday at noon here on KPOO. You can hear this show and past shows of Reality Sandwich at realitysandwichradio.com. We'll be back next week. I'm not exactly remembering who's on, but I know that we've got some great guests over the next couple of weeks, so I apologize for not immediately remembering, but you can get that at Reality Sandwich Radio as well. My name is Martin Matthews. I'm a certified medical hypnotherapist and healthful living advocate with Healthful Living, and you can read more about us at healthfulliving.org. We'll be back next Thursday at noon. Thanks for tuning in. You've been listening to Reality Sandwich on 89.5 KPOO, San Francisco. This show and any past shows of Reality Sandwich are available for free download at realitysandwichradio.com, where you can also read about upcoming shows. To learn more about Julie Matthews or Martin Matthews, go to healthfulliving.org. Thanks for listening.